please rise? The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Larson, Judge Reyes, Judge Ead. The Honorable Elise L. Larson presiding.
Good morning. You may be seated. Welcome to the Court of Appeals for the audio record. Today is February 28th, 2024. Today's argument is being live streamed, and we are also going to make an audio recording available. That audio recording will be available within 24 hours on our court's website. As a reminder, we do not allow any other recordings without the express permission of the Court of Appeals. This morning, we have four cases on our calendar for oral argument. We begin with the first case today, which is case number A23-0976 in the matter of the appeal by Hack. Good morning, counsel. Each of you, I'm sure you know, will be given 15 minutes for oral argument. Appellant, you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Before beginning your argument, if you could please identify yourselves and your clients for the record, that would be much appreciated. With that, appellant, are you ready to proceed?
Yes, Your Honor.
And feel free to adjust the podium as necessary.
Good morning. My name is Doug Anderson. I'm with the law firm Saul Ewing, and I represent relator Sheena Hack in this matter. May it please the court. Counsel. The DHS's misinterpretation and misapplication of the Maltreatment of Minors Act has caused my client, Ms. Sheena Hack, to be viewed as a child abuser in her tiny town of 500 people, simply because she used a baby monitor for 1 minute to supplement her child supervision plan. The commissioner's errors in its final decision break down into three main buckets. First, the Supreme Court in the Restorf decision interpreted neglect under the Maltreatment Act to have three distinct elements that sequentially build off of one another. The first element is provide for a plan. The second element is whether that plan provides for necessary supervision. And finally, only in the third element does the fact finder, quote, determine whether the supervision plan was appropriate in the abstract and whether the plan was executed appropriately in the specific context at issue. The commissioner makes legal errors by conflating three distinct elements when it utilizes facts from this third element of appropriateness under the circumstances to prove whether or not there was a plan in the first place under the first element or whether that plan provided necessary supervision under the second element.
Counsel, my question with regard to the plan element is, do we look at what the plan was in terms of the entire conduct, as in your client's plan was to watch the children over the baby monitor while going to the store, or are we isolated in terms of that element just looking at what was her plan for supervision? In this case, her plan for supervision was using a baby monitor. What's your interpretation of Restorf on that?
Restorf would look at not the particular facts of whether she was at a grocery store, how far away she was, as far as the first element of provide for. That's only in the third element where we look at that. So focusing on the first element of provide for a plan, where Restorf states that a provide for a plan means to create and execute a plan of supervision. So what we're looking at is whether Ms. Hack contemplated and created a plan and then executed that plan. So in this case, she contemplated a plan by thinking about the baby monitor for this small period of time when she would be outside of the facility. And rather than just going on a whim across the street, she planned by having that baby monitor and then executed by bringing the baby monitor with her.
So the plan was then for her to bring the baby monitor, to leave the residence, walk across the street, approximately 80 feet, to a grocery store, enter the grocery store, find noodles, purchase those noodles, and then leave the store, come back across the street, back to the residence where the 10 children were, correct?
So Her general supervision plan was a written plan on file with the county. And so while she went across the street for this moment, she had to adjust the plan. And that plan was utilizing the baby monitor because she knew she'd be across the street 80 feet away. Under the facts of this case, she actually did not make it into the grocery store. But had she made it into the grocery store, it would have been moments longer than the amount of time she was actually gone.
Okay, so we also know from the but her plan was to go to the grocery store to purchase noodles, find the noodles, purchase the noodles, and then walk back to the residence, correct? With the baby monitor, correct, yes.
So okay. Her plan...
And the baby monitor, you could listen to, and you could, it also had video capabilities, correct?
That's correct. The baby monitor had both audio and video capabilities. And the ALJ, actually on addendum page 12, made a specific factual finding that Ms. Heck could see and could hear the children on the baby monitor.
Is there anything in the record indicating that all of the children were in one room?
Your Honor, I don't believe that is specifically in the record.
Okay.
They were in one room, and the monitor was facing them, and she could see all of the children in that room. So the way this facility looks like, it's not a normal house. She spent thousands of dollars kind of making it childproofed, and there's two main rooms where the children were usually situated, and in this case, after she brought the children back from the bike ride, they were all situated in one room.
So the record indicates, I believe, that it took her approximately a minute to go from that residence, for lack of a better term, across the street to the entrance to the store, correct?
That's correct.
So based on that, according to her plan, it would have taken her a minute to go there. Say a minute to find the noodles, say another minute or so to actually purchase them, and then another minute or so to go back to the residence. So at a minimum, that would have been 4 or 5 minutes, according to her plan, correct?
Your Honor, I think under the record, we don't have how long it would have taken her had she actually entered the store.
We do know it would have taken her at least a minute to go across the street one way.
Correct. So she was, the ALJ's finding was less than 1 minute, but assuming it was 1 minute, it's 1 minute there and 1 minute back, and that's under the facts and the record, she would have been gone for
Taken her more than a moment to find the noodles and then pay for them too. I mean, there's some time built into that as well.
Correct, Your Honor. And I will say in this small town, the way it worked out was she would go to this grocery store. It's a tiny grocery store. It's not a Target or a Walmart or Hy-Vee. And she would usually just pick up the noodles, and the shopkeeper would write down on her tab. She wouldn't even have to pay. That's not in the record explicitly, but just kind of since we're talking about how long maybe it could have taken.
Are any of these hypotheticals even relevant?
No.
When we're reviewing the agency's decision, is it the agency's job to look at what actually happened, or is it the agency's job to look at what could have happened if there hadn't been intervention?
Your Honor, it's the agency's job to look at what actually happened, not to create hypothetical scenarios of what could have happened.
Do you have any case law to support that it's not appropriate for the agency to sort of expound on what could have happened absent intervention?
Sure. In the Restorf case, the Supreme Court makes note that hindsight is not to be utilized when rendering a maltreatment determination. And so, the reason behind that is because we're looking at whether the supervision plan as implemented at the time was appropriate.
But that's because the Supreme Court, the majority, was responding to the dissent, who was proposing that the child in Restorf could have wandered into traffic and been killed, and the dissent was arguing that, you know, no one would be reasonably debating that that would have been inappropriate supervision in that case if the child had died. It's just that the child hadn't. And the Supreme Court responds in the footnote about that point and says, well, it doesn't really matter. The analysis is the same regardless of the outcome. But what I don't understand is how the agency isn't supposed to consider what might happen when it gets to the appropriate for a child prong. Because it, to me, in analyzing appropriateness, you need to consider what might happen to a child, because it's fact specific. You need to know what the ages of the children are, and that drives whether or not a plan is appropriate, because you're considering what might happen for these particular kids. Why is that wrong?
So, Your Honor, looking at where the biggest hypotheticals occurred in this case, in the commissioner's final decision, were in the length of absence. There's a whole list of hypothetical scenarios of what could have happened. And that simply did not happen. And if we utilize these hypotheticals, it sort of defeats the purpose of actually looking at, under the facts, what did happen and whether, under those circumstances, the supervision plan was appropriate.
But length of absence is one of the factors under Clause 3, the sub-factors, correct?
That's correct.
And so I think, to jump back to Judge Reyes's point, and I think the respondent makes this point in their brief, that we know that the plan was to be away from the residence longer than the 1 minute. The only reason it was 1 minute is because your client saw the unannounced inspector at the front door and turned around. So whether or not we go to the lengths of hypotheticals that the commissioner did and thinking about what might have happened or what needed to happen in the store, we know that the plan was to be away from the residence longer. And in the appropriateness prong, wasn't the commissioner supposed to consider whether or not this whole plan was appropriate for leaving 10 kids as young as less than 2 years old in a residence with only a baby monitor to be supervising them?
That's correct, Your Honor. But still, we're looking at whether, under the facts of the particular case, the length of absence under the particular facts. So
let me just follow up on this, and then I'll be done with this line of questioning. Say we agree with you on provide for, that the commissioner got it wrong on provide for and necessary supervision. You would agree that if there's substantial evidence and it's not arbitrary capricious as to the appropriateness prong, then the result would be affirm, correct? If there's substantial evidence and it's not arbitrary and capricious.
Correct.
Okay, so my question for you is that the substantial evidence standard is, it has to be more than a scintilla of evidence, more than some evidence, more than any evidence, right? So can you tell me why there isn't more than a scintilla of evidence, more than some evidence, or more than any evidence that what the commissioner did, knowing we are deferential to the agency's decision here, it was based on the fact that it's undisputed that your client left the residence to go across the street and left 10 kids alone in the house with a baby monitor to watch them. Why isn't there more than a scintilla of evidence that that is neglect?
Your Honor, because under the facts, Ms. Hack was 80 feet away, and under what the ALJ determined, she had been outside the facility for under 1 minute. And those are the facts of the case.
But aren't you asking us to reweigh that and to come to a different... I mean, we might if we were sitting in the commissioner's shoes, but this is a deferential, substantial evidence review. So it would seem to me that you would need to point to a lack of any evidence that something like this happened. And this, I mean, even in Restorf, the Supreme Court remanded for more fact-finding, didn't make a judgment call.
Your Honor, under the facts that actually happened, she was only 80 feet away. Those are the facts that matter in this case, that she was 80 feet away and she had been gone for 1 minute. That's the way that this needs to be analyzed, because we're not looking at hypotheticals to create the best plan possible or anything like that. We're looking at the facts under the circumstances that actually occurred. Your Honor, I'm going to move into to touch on some necessary supervision since we haven't discussed that yet. Under Restorf, necessary supervision was interpreted to be watchful oversight. And the commissioner's final decision imposes requirements in the Maltreatment Act that are greater than the licensing rules. So on addendum page 12, the ALJ determined under the licensing rules, which are more restrictive, as Restorf notes, that Ms. Hack could see and could hear the children on the baby monitor, and not only was capable of intervening, but did intervene timely under the circumstances.
Counsel, you referred to the licensing rules. What about the licensing rules that talk about never leaving children under seven, I believe, out of the supervisor's sight?
So Your Honor, that is a screening guideline, and so that's whether the county investigator can screen in or out a investigation. And so if the child is under 7 years old, the county screens in for an investigation. And
right, I understand that. My question is, here's a bit of what you refer in your brief, and you just referred now to the appropriate use of the licensing guidelines. If licensing guidelines can be considered, why can't that licensing guideline be considered? I realize it's for screening in or out, but why can't that be considered in terms of looking at the totality of the circumstances?
Your Honor, it can be considered in looking at the totality of the circumstances, but that's just one factor. And that factor, because it's a screening guideline, cannot be the only factor that the commissioner hangs its hat on, because if that were the case, then the screening guideline or the screened-in investigation, there'd be no point of actually having an investigation because that'd be sufficient to demonstrate maltreatment.
And in fact, this statute is broader. It doesn't just apply to child care providers, and so there would be an issue if we apply guidelines that provide for child care providers to a statute that has more general applicability because a parent or a general supervisor isn't necessarily bound by the guidelines that relate to child care providers, even though your client is.
That's correct, Your Honor. Thank you. I see my time is up.
Thank you, counsel. You'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Counsel for respondent.
Morning, Your Honors. I'm Justin Anderson. I'm the Grant County Attorney here representing the department. I guess I would like to start on the line of questioning with respect to the hypotheticals and in terms of the plan. I wouldn't characterize the commissioner's decision as hypotheticals. Ms. Hack knew what she was doing, and the facts ferret that out. She was making an unnecessary trip, and she was going to leave her children. For the record, I think there is a differentiation. She had crossed the store, gone to the grocery store, and was back, as the ALJ found, within 1 minute. But that was not the circumstances that led her to alter her plan. She was going to leave the residence. She was going through the gate. She was going to go to the grocery store. She was going to search for the noodles. That all has to be taken into consideration.
What case law do you have to support that we should look not at the facts that actually occurred, but what her intent was?
I think that we can look at Restorf.
Because I really do think that, this case, what's strange about this case is the fact that what actually happened was she was gone for less than a minute, as opposed to what she was planning to have happen. And what's not clear to me in the case law is how the agency is supposed to evaluate those two when doing a neglect finding, or how they're supposed to balance what actually happened versus what she was intending to do.
So I think if you look at the appropriateness prong under Restorf, it requires not only this fact-specific examination, into whether the supervision plan was appropriate in the abstract. You know, so based on what she was doing, was the plan appropriate? So that's where I think we get to something beyond the fact that she was only gone for a minute. So it requires both the abstract, you know, this is what I was going to do. Is the plan that I developed appropriate for what I was going to do?
I mean, isn't it kind of similar to other license violations at the residence? You don't need to necessarily find that a child is injured because of the torn carpet or the wire sticking out from the railing or dirty laundry or whatever it might be, bedding. It's having good systems in place to ensure the safety of the children. That's why you're looking at the plan in the abstract. Is that what you're arguing?
Yes, and, you know, looking at that, you know, the entire intent of the maltreatment statute is to protect children. You know, the licensing rules are there to protect children as well. You know, and it is not necessary that there be a consequence of either the maltreatment or of the licensing violation in order to reach a conclusion that either one of those or both of those have been violated.
But there is a difference between the maltreatment statute and the licensing rules in terms of the maltreatment statute has broad applicability, including to parents.
Yes.
And so, you know, when we're interpreting and we're looking at that statute, we also have to keep in mind what would we expect for, you know, a reasonable supervision by parents of children. And so I think that there is some distinction, right, between specific licensing rules for people who have obtained a license to take care of several children and the maltreatment statute, which has broader applicability. Wouldn't you agree?
Yes, I would wholeheartedly agree. And I don't think the commissioner reached that strict liability per se. If you ever use a baby monitor, you know, it's going to be maltreatment. You know, in this case, the facts upon which the commissioner relied, the ones that the ALJ found to be true, are that there were 10 children there that were left unsupervised by an individual, whether it was a parent or whether it was someone else, to complete what was an unnecessary task. Those are the factors, or those are the facts that they looked at.
It's a very fact-specific analysis, right?
Correct.
But at the same time, in this case, this is a very, very small town. This grocery store is directly across the street. She has the baby monitor with her. You know, if we think about other plans in the abstract, a large yard like the woman had in Restorf, you know, an acre of property where the children might wander across the yard more than 80 feet away. And, you know, maybe the woman in Restorf who ran the child care center was the only one there that day, but could see them, but is more than 80 feet away and could see them just like Ms. Hack could in this case with the baby monitor. How is it that we're to conclude that this isn't, the decision of the commissioner isn't lacking in substantial evidence or arbitrary and capricious when, you know, the facts of this case are very different from someone in metropolitan Minneapolis walking away from a daycare and leaving 10 kids unattended?
Well, first, you know, in Restorf, there was a secondary provider. You know, interestingly, Restorf, you know, in provide for, it specifically included that the definition contemplates directly supervising a child or delegating that task to another individual, but Restorf did not define what directly is because it didn't need to, because that extra helper.
Wouldn't that interpretation eliminate all solo daycares? If we interpreted directly as you either need to be watching the child yourself or someone else needs to be watching them, you need to have a secondary person. Wouldn't that eliminate all solo daycares in the state? Because I don't think anyone here disagrees that a child care provider is going to need to use the bathroom, is going to need to go into the kitchen to prepare meals. Like, there are going to be reasons why a child care provider needs to leave the room and not directly have their eyes on the children at all times, which would be impossible.
No.
And so I struggle with the interpretation of directly as what that would do in Minnesota for solo daycare providers in general, when we certainly have rules that say one person can supervise 10 children in Minnesota.
And I don't know that that would eliminate it, because, you know, I think the distinction that the commissioner made in her order is the nature of the task that was being performed. This was not necessary. Noodles were not on the menu today, and maybe the kids wanted noodles, but it was not necessary. You know, the tasks that Your Honor referred to, bathroom and things of that nature, are necessary and are contemplated, and that's why I think, you know, the law rightfully requires a very fact-specific analysis of the circumstances.
What if she didn't have any food that day, and or she had, you know, something had happened and she needed to run across the street to get something for the kids? I mean, I suppose there'd be a violation for not having the food, but in that case, it would be a necessary trip to feed the kids, right?
Yes, it would have been a necessary trip. And I think, you know, that's why the analysis is so fact-specific. And there is a basis for the commissioner's decision to not adopt the ALJ's finding and to, you know, sustain the maltreatment determination initially made by the local agency.
Counsel, I want to go back to the plan element, and specifically, a lot of hypotheticals were thrown out, and I'm not big on hypotheticals, but I'm going to throw out another one. Let's assume, for the sake of argument, that the caretaker, her plan was to get in the car, drive 10 miles away to Costco, pick up groceries, kind of building on the Judge Eads' comment of, you know, there wasn't any food. And so she's got a big, huge grocery list. Go get those groceries, have the baby monitor, which has internet capabilities, so even though it's 10 miles away, she can still see and listen to the children. Pick those up and then come back and then provide for the children. She estimates she'll be gone 30 to 45 minutes. Okay, and her plan is to drive away. Her plan doesn't succeed because as she goes out the driveway, her car stalls, so she's not able to. Would she be liable for maltreatment by neglect, even if her plan wasn't executed based on what her plan was?
Hypotheticals are difficult because we don't know what the facts are. We know what the facts are in this case. Are there the same number of children?
Yes. Everything else is the same.
Everything else is the same. I would suggest, yes, that the plan didn't account for ultimately the safety of the children. Much like in this case, fortuitously, you know, the licensor appeared, thereby decreasing the time that Relator was away from the home.
Another, going back to the plan as well, a different aspect of it. If I understand your briefing correctly, it sounds like you're arguing that the plan, if the first element is not met, we don't need to look at the other ones. Appellants argue that we need to look at all of it together because it's part of that whole subsection, which includes looking at the totality of circumstances. So it's not like it's element, element A, element B, element C. Those are all just subsets of the same thing. Why don't they have the better argument on that point?
If I understand the question, you know, it's not if you fail one, you know, I'm certainly more accustomed to trying criminal cases, and if one element of the crime isn't met, then, you know, there's a not guilty verdict coming back. But I think the Restorff Court you know, analyze, you know, first you need a plan. And if that plan is not appropriate, you don't need to go down the line. But if the court wants to look at them in tandem, we don't believe that any of the elements, you know, to provide necessary or appropriateness have been, none of them were met by the plan that Ms. Hack had in place.
So here's my issue with the plan analysis by the commissioner. So the commissioner's decision is at no point should a supervision plan contemplate leaving a daycare unsupervised. And as we've discussed, the statute has broader applicability than just to child care centers. And so if we adopted this interpretation of what directly means, what would stop a parent from having a neglect finding brought against them because they decide to go and do yard work in their large yard while their child is napping? If you're not allowed to leave the building with your children unsupervised. So, I'm also from a rural area, so you know, big yards is a thing for me.
So as I was preparing, you know, I looked back at when my kids were little and you know what I did. And you know, I think because it's such a fact-specific analysis, you know, if my daughter was 1 year old and she was taking a nap, and I know that she naps for 2 days, and I have a baby monitor that, you know, vibrates when there are noises made, and I can intervene in the interim, and she is safe in her crib, then I don't think that's a circumstance where the commissioner would determine that it's maltreatment. I think it's different when you have...
But doesn't that go to appropriateness? And my question has to do with the commissioner's analysis of the plan and the fact that they said it's never a supervision plan to leave the building unattended. And I think that's something parents do often, is they have a baby monitor and they go do yard work. They sit around a bonfire. They do things while their children are sleeping inside of the house. And so I think that what you're talking about does go to appropriateness. Like, here we're talking about 10 children. Here we're talking about, you know, a licensed childcare worker. There's lots of facts that are different. But in terms of what is required for a supervision plan under a statute that applies broader than just to childcare providers, don't you see how there's some tension there in terms of whether or not a supervision plan can include physically leaving the home?
Yes, I do understand the concern, but, you know, unlike rest, or if the court did, or the commissioner did not take a strict liability per se analysis, and, you know, when a parent leaves a child under circumstances sleeping and is on the deck around a bonfire and is able to respond if that child needs something, you know, within seconds, that is different than the circumstances provided here.
Those aren't necessary activities either, right? I mean, going to sit by the bonfire, deciding to go downstairs and watch a movie while the child's sleeping and using the baby monitor, or like, I want to go out and finish this project in my garage. So, I mean, I think that would you acknowledge that there's some concern about the breadth, I think, that Judge Larson is speaking to, of the commissioner's reasoning and in the way that it would apply to parents? Because I think everyone agrees this is not unique. This kind of maltreatment analysis is not unique to a child care facility.
Yes, I would acknowledge, you know, that there might be some concern. But I trust, as the commissioner did in this case, that it would analyze it based upon you know, the facts as the law requires it to do.
Judge Larson, if I may ask one more question. Counsel, I want to go to the screening guidelines, and specifically when they talk about children under the age of 7 cannot be left unsupervised for any period of time. And the commissioner seemed to rely on that as one of the factors, not the overriding factor, but a factor. My question to you, is that appropriate in light of Restorf? Because Restorf specifically said the ALJ and this Court of Appeals erred by relying on the guidelines in determining what supervision meant. Is this an appropriate factor for the commissioner to rely on or not?
In making her maltreatment determination?
Correct. The overall determination, looking at all the totality of the circumstances.
In an ancillary way, I would suggest yes. You know, as I read the supervision guidelines, it requires to be within sight and hearing and able to intervene. And the argument was made that Ms. Hack did intervene. But had she gone through her plan and her day, or her outing, as the case may be, she would have been able to only intervene after an incident occurred. So, you know, I think that the screening guidelines contemplate being able to intervene to prevent something as opposed to reacting to something. Thank you.
Thank you. Councilor Pellant, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. I just want to hit a couple of points specifically on the appropriateness factors. In respondents' discussion, there is mention of the 10 children being left, and that's something the commissioner considered in the appropriateness factor. That is not a listed consideration in the statute, and the statute is not exhaustive. It can consider the number. However, there's two issues. One, the commissioner's decision does not have any analysis. It simply says the number of children left was significant and must also be considered in making this determination. So it doesn't say why the number is important.
Well, actually, Council, I think it does, because it does, as I just mentioned, I asked, you know, both of you, the screening guidelines talk about the number of children and that children under age of 7 cannot be left unsupervised for any period of time. Now, as we discussed, that's a screening guideline, but that appears to be a factor that at least can be considered, because it's a non-exclusive list. Speaking for myself, I don't think it's the, you know, overriding factor, but it seems to be one that can be considered. Why isn't that discussion dovetailing with what you said about 10 children under the age of 8?
So, Your Honor, the number of children itself versus any child, any number of children under 7 for this screening guideline, looking at just the number of children, which was 10, under the licensing ratios, providers can, with a C1 license, can care for up to 12 children. Ms. Hack had 10 in her care. So that's a per se statement by the DHS that the number itself is reasonable and appropriate for any person to watch 10 children.
So but just why isn't that a factor to consider under the totality of the circumstances? This isn't a situation in which she's supervising 2 children under that are, you know, 10 years old versus 10 children that are all 8 years or under. It's not, again, I don't think it's necessarily determinative, but it's certainly looking at the totality of the circumstances. So what's wrong with that, I guess, is my question.
So, Your Honor, it can be considered in the totality of the circumstances, but in this case, the commissioner just didn't explain why the number matters. There's just no explanation.
And isn't it, in fact, I mean, just physically impossible for one person to directly look at 10 children at all times, 5 days a week, year round? I mean, supervisors do have to go to the bathroom. I think we all recognize that. There are events that happen during the day. And so the reason why that might be a screening guideline as opposed to an actual rule that caregivers need to follow under all circumstances is because the rules contemplate the very fact that these are people who have human needs, and it may be they may not physically be able to directly supervise 8 hours a day 10 children and have their eyes physically on 10 children at once. And if we were to require that, I do think that there might be a problem with making it really challenging to have solo daycares if that was the rule that we adopted. Wouldn't you agree?
I do agree with that, Your Honor.
Counsel, I want to follow up on the, I realize you're talking about appropriateness, but since we went to the directly supervised, I wanted to follow up on that a little bit, because I think the parties agree that the definition of directly means, quote, without anyone or anything intervening.
So, Your Honor.
Such as directly responsible. And Restorf makes clear, as the Supreme Court told us, that does not mean, directly supervising does not mean that you have to be within sight or sound. In other words, that's not a requirement under Restorf.
Your Honor, so looking just at the provide for element in Restorf, the main holding of Restorf was provide for is whether the provider creates and executes a plan for supervision. The second sentence after that, the Supreme Court says that definition, such a definition, contemplates that a supervisor may directly supervise or delegate the task to another person. And
right.
The reason Restorf discussed that is because in that case, Restorf delegated the task to a 12-year-old
right.
girl. So as far as the direct versus indirect, or the direct definition of anyone or anything intervening, that is not a workable definition, because in this case, the argument is the anything intervening is the baby monitor. But you can see in other circumstances, the anything could be a door in the house, like going to the bathroom. If there's a door in the way, under that definition strictly, and we're looking just at provide for, we're not looking at appropriateness here, under that definition, the provider is either required to have the door open while they're going to the bathroom or close the door and be subject to maltreatment. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you to both counsel for your arguments in this case today. The case has been submitted, and we will issue an opinion in the time prescribed by statute. Thank you.